Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies. I talked about those things that work for me, but also those big epic fails that I learned from. I sometimes share blueprints or roadmaps. I interview experts because I'm also on this learning journey as well. And all because I ultimately believe that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And so today we're going to be talking about the idea of PBL, project-based learning, something we talk about a lot on this podcast, and how we make time for PBL. So this is one of the most common questions I get emailed to me. By the way, my blog, if you don't follow me, is spencerauthor.com. And it's also one of the most common questions I get when I lead workshops, when I do keynotes. And it really is this recognition that every one of us, wherever you are in education, every one of us has a packed time schedule, a lot of content to teach. And there's that big question of how do I make time for something as big as project-based learning? So without further ado, let's take a dive into this topic of making time for project-based learning when we have limited time, lots of content, lots of standards, and a lot of things making it a challenge. When I was in my second year of teaching, I wanted so badly to implement project-based learning. This, despite the fact that I didn't really know the term project-based learning, I simply knew that I wanted students to engage in meaningful projects where they learned the content through the project rather than just doing a culminating project. I'd been doing short culminating projects, but they always felt rushed to me. And I knew that I would need to make time for PBL and that this would take some kind of big commitment on my part. For me, this would be a leap into the unknown. To be honest, I was scared. I was scared that the project would fail. I was worried that students would misbehave. I was scared that I wouldn't cover all the standards that we need to cover. But I was also scared of letting go of control. Eventually, I chose to take the leap. Well, kind of. I actually chose the most low-risk opportunity to give PBL a shot. During our state-mandated standardized testing week, I had half a day each day to try something bold. It was my free pass to make as many mistakes as I could, knowing that there really wouldn't be very many consequences for this. I mean, this was testing week. All I had to do was make sure kids finished their tests and stayed quiet. And I'm telling you, when I say I had the permission to make mistakes, I took advantage of that. I made a ton of mistakes. And this first project I did was not perfect. In fact, it was so riddled with mistakes and things that I thought I need to do this differently and I need to do that differently. I did this documentary project. It took about 2 weeks to do. But amid all my ineptitude, my students engaged in meaningful PBL. And that was the start of a longer journey of authentic learning. I share that because when it comes to PBL, it can feel like you're simply adding another item onto an already crowded plate. However, PBL isn't about adding things to your plate. It's about rearranging your plate so that students can work at a deeper level. But how exactly does this work? How do we save time during project-based learning? Well, I'm going to share 9 different strategies for maximizing the time in project-based learning. Before I get there, I want to share a quick caveat. It's all about context. There are so many human dynamics at work, and ultimately, you know your students the best. You are the experts. Often we learn through trial and error. I had projects that tanked or went a full week off course. I still don't have it figured out perfectly myself as a college professor who tries to implement some level of PBL into my courses right now. But I've learned a few of these strategies, and so I'm going to share these 9 different strategies. Number 1, less teacher talk. So this is the idea that sometimes we spend too much time engaging in teacher talk. In fact, a lot of what we do is explaining directions. And last week, if you listened to my podcast on the bay leaves of education, I'm a huge fan of front-loading the vocabulary, the directions, doing pre-recorded videos where I explain the directions in a video. And that saves an awful lot of time. But there's another element at work too, which is that direct instruction can feel so efficient as a way to convey information. And it is. You talk, students listen, they take notes, that's it, right? Well, the reality is that in PBL, students spend more time doing the work themselves. They ask more questions and find more answers on their own. Sometimes I'm a guide helping them one-on-one. Other times I'm a curator sharing specific resources. But the goal is for me to talk less and for the students to talk more. While this can feel less efficient, students can learn at a deeper level and they actually retain the information for a longer period of time. So what we know is that actually this process of PBL can often lead to more rehearsal and retrieval, and therefore more of the information sticks in terms of the long-term memory. I do want to share a quick piece of nuance here. This doesn't mean that we abandon direct instruction. It's important that we start longer PBL units with front-loaded vocabulary, a concept attainment lesson, and direct instruction. That is necessary to activate prior knowledge. We also need to add strategic moments of direct instruction embedded inside of PBL units. So find key moments during projects when students will engage in direct instruction. And what this does is it reduces cognitive load and provides necessary moments where students can practice the key skills and concepts that they need. Big idea number 2, or second way that we can do this, is by shortening the timeline, but building in wiggle room. Ever notice that students tend to waste time at the beginning and middle of a project and then rush toward the end to get it all done? Well, it turns out that we tend to work harder on a task when we are close to finishing it. By contrast, there's this idea called Parkinson's Law that explains how work expands to the allotted time. There's a great Planet Money episode that I love that really dives into this in depth. You can go check it out in the show notes. But the key idea is that if you give yourself 3 weeks to do a project that should only take 2 weeks, well, you're going to take all 3 weeks. It's something we all do. Now, there are definitely times when students rush through a project and finish it early, but students will often spend longer than normal on a project because the timelines are too loose. I found that it's actually easier to set time deadlines and give students some additional days rather than creating really loose time deadlines. So what you do is you create a time deadline that's tighter, and then you allow for a more open permission in terms of wiggle room in between. So you might say, all right, we're going to do this particular thing in 3 days, knowing it might take 4 days, and you build that wiggle room into it. It's also important that we break projects into phases. So if you are familiar with the launch cycle, which I designed with my friend AJ Giuliani, there are these different phases: look, listen, and learn, ask tons of questions, understand the process of the problem, navigating ideas, creating a prototype, highlighting and fixing. These phases are the parts of a project. So they're different phases of the project. And what that does is it breaks the project down into these stages and phases, which again, similar to giving directions and indirect instruction, this will reduce student cognitive load. If you're familiar with the inquiry process, you know, provocation, ask questions, research, analyze data, share insights, those are all different ways that we build phases into the project. But sometimes students struggle to meet deadlines, which leads to the next point. We need to find a balance of quantity and quality. When I first began teaching, I would wait for the slowest student to finish an assignment before moving on as a class. So when it took a student 35 minutes to write a paragraph, well, we would wait 35 minutes. I then stuck with that same time frame for the entire year. And oh my gosh, things move slowly. A few months into the school year, though, I had students fill out a survey on my teaching. And to my surprise, the biggest complaint was that we were moving too slowly. Finally, I realized that we could move faster and I could excuse students from a second assignment to let them finish that paragraph on their own. Eventually, this led to a breakthrough for me. What if I got rid of the requirements around quantity and focused instead on quality? So during a warm-up, I tried to frame it differently where I said, try and write at least a paragraph. Many of you will do two or three, but the goal should be to get your thoughts across clearly. And then I created these flexible assignments in terms of the quantity of work. It took some training for students. Some of them were like, well, it's unfair. Why am I doing more? Why is that person getting away with doing less? I compared it to what we did during silent reading, right? Not everyone reads the same amount. And suddenly it began to click. And the notion here is what we're saying is that the system should fit the students as often as we make the student fit into the system. So there's this give and take both ways. And again, it really comes down to building on both quality and quantity. When working on blogging projects, I had students who wrote 10 blog posts, others who wrote 3, and that was okay. At the same time, there's a time and a place to really focus on quantity. And what that means is get as many ideas as you can during brainstorm out as possible and just get those ideas out. Or focus on speed. We're going to work on prototyping as fast as possible. And in these moments, we're actually focusing on the quantity to save time. So there's a benefit of both this balance of focusing on the quality and the quantity at the same time. Idea number 4 is to use structures to save time. So early on in the PBL journey, I told students, I want you to make a documentary. You need to develop a plan and then go make it happen. Well, it didn't happen. Students stood around talking without getting started. The larger project was too daunting. And I realized that I would need to incorporate structures and protocols that would build interdependence and collaboration. I've written about these before. You can check them out on my blog. But the core idea is that you give students a structure, a framework, a protocol that they can use in their creative work. And actually, structures are vital for creative productivity. It turns out that people who are inexperienced at a task often fail to plan and have more false starts and mistakes than those who have the opportunity to plan ahead. This is kind of obvious. We see it, right? If you're new at a creative work, you're going to make more mistakes. But what happens is structures provide the necessary creative constraint that push divergent thinking, and at the same time, it will save time. One of the things that I find fascinating about the work that I've done on PBL and creativity and the interviews I've done with people in different industries is just how often organizations, teams, and companies from some of the most creative and innovative spaces use protocols and structures to guide their creative work. And one of my favorite examples is Pixar. Pixar is constantly using a set of protocols and structures that help guide them in their creative productivity. So as you're doing PBL, use graphic organizers, structures, Kagan structures for collaboration. I have a 20-minute peer feedback process I use for peer feedback. You know, incorporate these different protocols into every phase of the project that you're doing. Number 5 is chunk your standards. The traditional approach to teaching focuses on isolating skills and teaching them in a systematic way to students. There's a time and a place for this, right? So for example, if your students are learning how to read, you want a systematic approach to phonics and blending and morphology. That's really important. But for other aspects of the teaching that you do, what you can do is chunk your standards. You can connect them to one another, and in the process, you learn multiple standards at the same time. So what this means is in PBL, students can learn a concept while practicing a skill at the same time. They can work on multiple interconnected standards instead of going sequentially through each standard. And the whole goal here is that you actually save time because you're not stopping teaching a new standard, stopping teaching a new standard, stopping. You're teaching multiple standards, and it allows you to actually dive deeper while covering more standards for a longer amount of time. So that's the idea of chunking our standards, or you could say blending our standards, connecting our standards, whatever language fits best for you. Number six is to teach new content through the project. I love this idea from PBL Works that one of the key differentiators between a culminating project and a PBL unit is that in true PBL, students should be learning through the project rather than first learning the content and then completing a project afterwards. So that's the sixth idea, is you actually save time because you're not teaching a unit and then doing a project, teaching a unit and then doing a project. You're saying they're going to learn the content, the standards, they're going to master those as they do the project itself. Number seven, assess as you go. With project-based learning, you can incorporate frequent formative assessments into each phase of the project. So you don't have to stop doing the project to go take an assessment. Here you treat assessment as a verb rather than a noun. It's something that you do rather than simply something that you have to take. You can observe students as they work. You can look at some of the artifacts that they complete as they do the project. You can embed self-assessment, peer feedback, shorter conferences into it. And what you're doing is you're building that notion of assessing as you go rather than stopping the project to go take a test. In the process, you save time because students aren't doing weekly tests or quizzes. Now, this, I realize, can feel risky. I remember wondering whether or not my observations were accurate, feeling afraid that, you know, what if I'm measuring the wrong thing? And I think that's where actually you kind of have to learn how to tweak things, how to try new approaches, how to figure out what works best for you, but also how to, for lack of a better term, trust your gut a little bit. I know it's important that we have valid and reliable measures, but you often observe students learning, and that observation is accurate. You have to learn as a teacher to trust that you can believe what you see as you see students work. So that's the seventh idea. It's the notion of assessing as you go. Number eight, go with an interdisciplinary project. In my fourth year of teaching, I started this thing called Project Impact at our school. And we had this amazing PBL project that also did inquiry-based learning. We had service learning built into it. We had a media lab that we were kind of creating in an informal basis. We called it the Social Voice Media at the time. And I fortunately worked with these four other educators who were fantastic teachers. And I remember one point saying, I'd love to do this large-scale service learning project, but I'm running out of time. And my ELL teacher said, well, judging from what you just described, there's a lot of research components. Could we partner and we'll cover all of those research standards that we do in language arts? I nodded. And then the math teacher said, wait, what if we added aspects of statistical analysis, graphing, other standards? He then pointed out that ELA and social studies, the two of us often partnered, but he wanted to see more math brought into service learning and project-based learning. Our science teacher then pointed out some of her standards, and then we had this amazing special ed teacher who brought in what she could do, and suddenly we had this really cool six-day project that would run right before winter break. And to me, that's a reminder of the power, the sort of time-saving power of doing interdisciplinary work. The final idea is number nine, take advantage of AI. This last one is more of an emerging element. I've written before about how we can use AI for project-based learning, so I'm not going to take too much of a dive into it. I recognize that we need to make sure that things are FERPA, SIPA, COPPA compliant, that these tools that we're using are actually being done ethically, that we're being careful about student data, all of that. But in general, what I will say is technology tends to make tasks faster and cheaper when it comes to creative work. So in the 1980s, when I made a slideshow, it required physical pictures with a camera that I would have to develop at a drugstore. And then I would put it into a slide carousel. It was a laborious process, but it was also expensive to make a slide presentation. To record audio meant using reel-to-reel tape on these big magnetic reels. To interview an expert meant literally paying money to talk long distance on the phone with people. Now, if we think about it this way, AI has the potential to save us a lot of time in video editing, audio editing, image generation, project management, data analysis, visualization, even in some cases creating some initial images, writing code, whatever it may be, that students take the sort of vanilla that exists from the AI, the students then take and modify to make on their own. And so if we think about it this way, AI really will give us the potential to save a lot of time. And we're just in the beginning elements of using AI to our advantage within project-based learning. So again, those are the nine different ideas for saving time during PBL. Ultimately, project-based learning involves a different way of thinking. It's about choosing quality over quantity, about shifting towards student ownership. And while it can sometimes feel like things are moving more slowly, you can actually accomplish more and students can learn at a deeper level. So with that in mind, I will say just take the leap, try it, and don't try with something massive. Try with something small, like testing week or the week after testing week or the few days before winter break or spring break or summer vacation. Whatever it may be, try something small and low risk, and implement some of these strategies and just see what works for you. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or anywhere that you currently get your podcasts? And if you have any ideas for shows that you would love for me to create, feel free to email me at john@spencerauthor.com. Any questions that you might have. And again, please consider leaving a review on any of the places and subscribing to wherever it is that you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.